time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 22nd of March 2014. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oniroa. I'm Chris Walker, and on Saturday the 22nd of March, I talked to the former Chief Executive of the Problem Gambling Foundation, John Stansfield, and I spoke to the Chair of the Waiheke Local Board, Paul Walden. Yesterday it was announced, it came out of the news, I presume the decision was made a little earlier, that the funding for treatment of problem gambling, which has previously been held by the Problem Gambling Foundation, was to be switched, and the contract will now go to the Salvation Army. And on the island here we have former Chief Executive of the Problem Gambling Foundation, John Stansfield, and he's with me this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Chris.
So I'm imagining that you're unhappy about this.
Yes, I am pretty grumpy about it, really, Chris. It's a real betrayal of the public health approach to problem gambling, which has been pioneered in New Zealand and which we're world famous for, and which is actually having results in that we now have John Key's little foray with the casino aside, less pokie machines and a declining level of harm.
So we'll talk about this public health approach to gambling, but the actual contract, which has now gone to Salvation Army, this contract is around treatment and support for people who have fallen into issues with gambling, isn't it?
No, it's broader than that, Chris. Gambling treatment or gambling services in New Zealand come under the Gambling Act 2003, which defines gambling as a public health issue. And so you've got two approaches, and you have to apply both approaches. One of those is the treatment end, which looks after people who have been harmed after the harm has happened. And that's really important work to rebuild their lives and their relationships with their families, but it doesn't actually stop people getting harmed. The other part of it is the public health approach, which says, actually, this is a supply-side issue. The reason people are harmed is because we have this very unsafe product, a pokie machine, which if you use it in the way that it's normally used and you use it regularly, the normal result will be that you're harmed. So we have to find ways of reducing that. You can do that in two ways. One is to make the machine safer, which is completely possible to do, but which government rejected later last year, and the other is to reduce the number of machines that are out there. And you do that by working with communities so that they get a strong voice. And guess what? No community ever asked for more pokie machines.
Yeah, but it would be fair to say that there is a mixed opinion in the community about whether they're a good or bad thing, isn't it? I mean, we've seen that on the island. So with the RSA, there's certainly lots of people who were saying, yeah, no, we're okay.
There's two major pieces of work done on that are academically rigorous, and they're done by the Department of Internal Affairs, and they're the Public Attitudes to Gambling surveys, and those show unequivocally that New Zealanders think there are too many pokie machines, that they think using pokie machines to raise money is a bad way of doing it, and that pokie machines lead to crime.
So with the switch to the Salvation Army, so do they not focus on the public health aspect?
Well, there are some people, such as the National Party blogger David Farah, and of course our own local Ho Jones in her blog, who claim that because the Salvation Army made a submission against the casino, that both the organisations are equally capable of this. But Chris, a 7-year-old with an internet connection and a couple of minutes on Google could show unequivocally that the Problem Gambling Foundation is the leader in the public health approach in trying to restrict the industry, not just in New Zealand but internationally.
Yeah, but does leadership in that area doesn't negate the fact that other organisations could take that same approach?
The Salvation Army have a very small workforce in problem gambling, 18 as opposed to, it was 78 when I was there. I think it's in the high 60s now. They don't have leadership in public health. So they don't have, specialists in public health. We've had, public health physicians, people with masters in public health. We've had the School of Population Health at Auckland University's problem gambling unit housed in our building. We are the public health leaders around the world, and it's not just about leadership, you're quite right, it's also about activity. If you were to look at the number of submissions that have been made. You know, Manukau City Council, for instance, when it was still around, got 6,000 submissions from its citizens saying, we don't want any more pokies, we want you to restrict them. Now, that's work done by communities aided by the Problem Gambling Foundation's public health team. The Salvation Army, God bless them, they're good tradesmen, and you know they do good work in the sphere that is their work, but they need to be a bit more honest with themselves. They need to look at their own capability and realise they really don't have the knackers for a big fight. And the days of taking on a major corporation like Sky City with a copy of War Cry and a tambourine are well and truly over.
So is part of the issue here then that if you're taking this public health approach, that there is a line which perhaps the Problem Gambling Foundation has stepped over between that kind of public health awareness and political advocacy? You know, it's one thing to say, okay, so we need to put protections in place to stop people being harmed by gambling, but when that crosses into, say, the submissions against the casino expansion and so on, you know, that line becomes quite wide and quite fuzzy.
Well, that would be like saying that the Ministry of Health shouldn't make submissions against expansion of tobacco, because we're dealing with the same kind of problem here. A product which, if used normally and regularly, will cause harm. And internationally, it's becoming recognised that's the moral equivalent, if you like, is the tobacco industry. There's two things to say about the advocacy in that. First of all, National MP To Henare has taken real exception to the fact that PGF is involved in advocacy, and he would like a society in which any NGO which has any government money can't do that. And there is one there for him. It's North Korea, and he should bugger off there quick smart, because he'd get on just fine. Second thing about the advocacy is that you have to have skill and effective advocates, and you do have to understand where the line is. And we understand at PGF very well where the line is, but it's not just the ministry's money that we apply to advocacy. We have our own business arm, we have rental income, we have other income from donations, etc. That's our money, and if we want to use it to advance the cause of eliminating gambling harm, then it's frankly nobody's business that we do it, and we get a lot of support from people for doing it. What you have internationally and what the National Party and the gambling industry would like is very fractionated services with very, very small operations which only do the treatment, and there's no voice back, you know. And what you have in gambling is an industry, just a normal industry in one respect, that wants to expand, a community which can be harmed and needs to be protected, and those interests need to be mediated. In this case, they need to be mediated by the government, but the government, of course, is clearly compromised because they do take donations from Sky City, and they obviously have a very close and cosy relationship with other parts of the gambling industry. So they're not the impartial mediator that's needed to mediate those interests.
So the money comes from the Ministry of Health, I presume?
The money comes from gamblers.
Yeah,
gamblers lose money in machines, and that creates a levy which is set by the Gambling Commission, and it's then passed to the Ministry of Health.
Right.
It's not Ministry of Health money in the same way as taxpayers' money.
In terms of dishing it out for these contracts, the Ministry of Health oversees that process.
The Ministry is the administrator of it. Yep. And interestingly, Chris, the Ministry's costs of administration have gone up every year that the levy's been in place, while the services they're purchasing has gone down.
So what's the time frame on a contract? Is it 3-year, a year? How does that work?
the ministry's contracts have been in complete and utter disarray. They've been rolling them over on a three-month basis. There's complete uncertainty in the industry around that. Moreover, they are what we call dinosaur contracts. Contracting within with government has moved away from what you call input contracting to output contracting, now to outcome contracting. So what a government wants to purchase is the change you're going to make. In the case of the ministry's contracts, contrary to all of the advice from Treasury and all of the standards being set by the Office of the Auditor General, the Ministry is continuing with input contracting. That is, they want to decide how many people you employ, as if in some way that's related to the outputs.
So when the Ministry puts out calls for interest for these contracts, they're looking for outcomes, as you say. Presumably they're also looking at
they're not purchasing outcomes, that's the point.
No, but that's what they say they're doing, isn't it? I mean,
They may say that's what they're doing, but their contracts are purchasing inputs.
Yeah, but they're also looking at the cost that it can be offered for. So, you know, Problem Gambling Foundation comes along and says, well, for this much money, we can do this. And Salvation Army says, well, for this much money, we can do that. So that's the basis of awarding the contract, one presumes.
Well, quite probably so, although a smarter government would be awarding the contract on the quality of the output and the length that it lasted. But I think where you're going with this is that it's a cheaper price. And just to cut to the chase here, the minister's already admitted it's not a cheaper price.
Right. Yeah. So where does this leave the Problem Gambling Foundation? I mean, presumably, that advocacy role, if that's being funded from other sources, will still continue.
Well, it's the advocacy role is one end of the public health approach. It's like the pinnacle that sits on a pyramid. You can't run the pinnacle unless you have the infrastructure and the accounting services and the Problem Gambling Research Library and the public health team and all those other things it sits upon. So there are some tough decisions to be made by the PGF board, and I wish them every well with it. But just to come back to your point about whose money it is, 25,000 gamblers and their families have been helped by the Problem Gambling Foundation. None of them were asked whether they want to go into counselling with a copy of War Cry and a Tambourine.
Well, yeah, okay. So the Salvation Army program. Let's talk. I'm not expecting you to be completely familiar with them, but I mean, from what you know of the program they offer, how does that differ in substance from the program that, say, someone would receive, someone who's into the treatment end of the scale?
Absolutely.
From
Problem Gambling Foundation. The Salvation Army is informed by their own model of treatment, and that's absolutely fine. It's they have a 12-step approach to things. That's absolutely fine. Doesn't work for everybody. No bright person would say, let's only have one model of treatment when we know it doesn't work for everybody. They don't have. They are informed by the addictions paradigm. And the addictions paradigm says there's something the matter with Chris Walker. I know a lot of your listeners will agree, but there's something the matter with Chris Walker that he's got this gambling problem. Okay. An alternative paradigm, a public health paradigm, says actually Chris Walker has been has fallen victim to an unsafe environment. And so it treats Chris Walker in a different way. Under an addictions paradigm, under a 12-step, you put your hand up and you say, I am powerless, there must be a higher power. Under a more public health approach, we say, okay, Chris, how do we rediscover your power? How do you take power over not only this problem that's happening to you now, but how do you engage in the policy debate around what kind of environment is around you? So it's rehabilitative in the sense that it's restore to the full rights of citizenship.
And you've started you've already kind of, I suppose, stepped into campaigning mode around this?
Oh, absolutely. But, it's the Problem Gambling Foundation's fight. I've had various members of the media ring me, and I'm very grateful for that. And I've checked out on each occasion with the foundation. They're happy for me to speak on my own behalf, not on their behalf, and they are. And, you know, I guess because I'm not still there trying to negotiate something with the ministry, I have the benefit of being able to have a more free and frank and honest discussion with the public.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for joining us this morning, John.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Chris.
That's John Stansfield, former Chief Executive of the Problem Gambling Foundation, who, it was announced yesterday, have lost the contract for treatment of problem gambling to the Salvation Army.
Wakey Radio.
We're in the midst of a flurry of consultation from the local board, and here to talk about that is the chair of the local board, Paul Walden. How are you, Paul?
Yeah, good morning.
Let's get to first things first. Why are you driving a big blue truck with a swimming pool on top?
Goodness me, that's a convoluted, interesting question.
For those of you who can't see it, there's a Land Rover. It's a blue Land Rover, but it's got this big white box on top, which looks like a paddling pool.
Yeah, my family's outgrown our car, essentially.
Is this the community pool, a portable pool?
Yes, and so on the roof of the car, we've managed to find a pool, and it's mobile. It can be used by all of the community.
Excellent.
Won't just be confined to the high school, but it does get, you know, go to the high school every day.
Yeah. All right. So, well, that's one thing ticked off on the plan. So, before we get into this, I'm trying to get my head around exactly what it is that's been consulted on. There seems to be a whole lot of different things. So, we've got an Auckland plan, yep. And Waiheke, the local board, has a part within that. There's a Waiheke, there's a local board plan, but there's also a local board agreement.
Yeah, that's right.
So, what the heck are we actually talking about at the moment?
Yeah, it is. Not confusing, but it's quite involved. But there's an annual agreement which gets negotiated every year with the governing body, and essentially it's the governing body and the mayor signing off the budgets for the whole region. And that annual agreement is in part directed by the local board plan, which is which is revised every 3 years, and also the long-term 10-year plan. And then sort of overarching above all that there is the Auckland plan, which is the sort of 40, 50-year vision for the whole Auckland region, the super city. The challenge at the moment is we've just gone through a consultation process for the annual plan. That budget's set in stone, in a sense, and, you know, the controversy there has been looking at how we can shift some of that money around to, you know, perhaps, you know, reprioritise what we're doing as a council within the community over the next year. And largely that's been driven out of the school rebuild and an opportunity to consider and look at a pool there. So, and then separately, what we're now working through is the 3-year local board plan. And so that's what we're consulting on. So there's been a series of consultations on that there. There's two more this afternoon. The plan's broken down into priorities. We've identified 6 priorities. And then essentially the process is... And this is a pre-process, so we haven't... This isn't a formal consultation, but this is a sort of over and above effort that we've made to go out to the community before we, you know, put together the formal draft and say this is where our thoughts are at.
So that local board plan, does it use the previous plan as a starting point and kind of amend, you know, chop change, or do you go back to a blank page?
There was, I mean, you know, we haven't thrown the old plan out. I mean, there was some really good stuff there, and so we've really looked to build off that, but also refine things in other areas. And I guess one of the... When we... As a community, I guess the question that needs to be asked is, what's the point of having a plan? Because, you know, politicians just seem to do what they want anyway. And, you know, for me, the significance is that, you know, we've got thousands and thousands of staff that work for Auckland Council and various council-controlled organisations. And this is their guidebook as to what the local board's doing and where it's going and what the community's aspirations are. And so it's the really effective way to actually get some performance out of Auckland Council staff. And I think that's one of the biggest issues facing Waiheke, in that we are stuck on an island, we're isolated, we're a vocal community, and we're not shy to share our differing opinions when they differ. And so for many council administrators, that's sort of easily falls into the too hard basket. And so it's a matter of us as a community very clearly articulating what we want. And some of the deficiencies is a strong word, and it's not the right word for this, but I guess some of what we're looking to achieve is to be a lot more specific in our plan.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because, I mean, I look at the, and as I say, it does seem a quagmire to wade you through and figure out exactly what you've been consulted on. But some of the stuff, which is in, where are we, the local board agreement part, seems anything but specific. I mean, there are some specifics in there, but there's some stuff which is anything but specific.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
So let's take, look, you know, for example, where are we? This, yeah, so we've got some stuff here around accessibility.
Yep.
Okay. Becoming an accessible local board and area by making community infrastructure and communication to the community more accessible. That's not specific. That's waffle, Paul.
Yeah, no, look, accessibility is an interesting one. Firstly, specifically with relation to the annual plan, which is the document that, you know, the local board agreement, which is the one-year document, we haven't put too much effort on that, because really, the smart money at this point in time is, as a community, getting our heads together and banging out the three-year plan. The budgets are largely set for the coming year. The mayor's made it quite clear that there's not going to be any amounts of new money coming into the budget. There's a whole lot of accessibility, of advocacy items that are in there, and that accessibility one's a really interesting one. And again, it's one of the challenges that we'll look to address through our local board plan, but essentially there's a accessibility advocacy group that was set up at the time of the World Cup rugby called Be Accessible, and they were partly funded by the government and the council to drive accessibility outcomes for Auckland through the World Cup. And when we talk about accessibility, it's accessibility for, you know, for elderly, for mothers with kids, you know, for anyone that's, you know, I guess, for whatever reason, is less able than perhaps you and I. And so it covers a pretty wide range of things. And they've put a huge amount of effort into our local board plan, but when I look around our community and the challenges that we face here, most of those are actually not related to functions that the local board perform. Our biggest accessibility challenge is Auckland Transport. Their roading infrastructure, you know, footpaths, all of that sort of infrastructure stuff. You know, but also there's a whole lot of regulatory things with, you know, Building Act and that sort of stuff. So one of our challenges will be to go back to these guys and say, well, you know, so, you know, in a sense we're going to put accessibility is an overarching outcome that the local board's going to be driving for, but also, you know, very pushing, you know, Be Accessible back onto Auckland Transport and these other organisations to make sure that they're getting performance out of them. Because one of the frustrations that I'm finding almost daily is that where there's deficiencies within council or council-controlled organisations, the local boards become the fall guy to fix it up. And so a lot of our community discretionary budgets are getting used to pick up the pieces for work that should already be done by council. And again, you know, the smart money's in the three-year plan, which is what we're consulting on presently.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously one of the thing that everyone's talking about is this reprioritisation of funding from some projects that were earmarked for funding by the previous board.
Yep.
You know, the sports park, the what's it, boat ramp and so on, into the pool.
Yep.
And, you know, and there's been conjecture, okay, well, the money's going to disappear, and I know you've responded to that and said, well, no, it's not. It's, you know, it's still within the board's control. However, there is, I suppose, underpinning that concern is that we had some specific projects which people could see were going to be completed into something which is kind of in the never-never. I mean, it might happen, it might not. So, you know, we get to the end, you know, I mean, and, I mean, we're 6 months in, so you've got 2.5 years, you know, if by the time you get the plan completed, we'll be a year in, and then that gives you 2 years, and 2 years isn't a lot of time to dig a hole and put up a pool, you know, find the ground and get the rest of the money in and the rest of it. So there is a very good chance that we could get to the end of 3 years and this thing won't be done. And then what happens?
Yeah,
then so this money's been floating around, the other stuff's not done.
Look, the reason that we have looked to reprioritise this money out of our through our annual plan process, you know, which is again the 1 year plan, and And I'd just emphasise the point that we didn't need to go through the special consultative procedure, that we could have done this by board resolution, but we wanted to have a robust conversation as a community and be up front. We are faced with a situation where Tahurahi Primary and Waiheke High School are about to get rebuilt. And so essentially all of the building and infrastructure that you see there is likely to be not there in 2 years' time, and we'll be looking at a new school. Over the past 2 years, the local board has done a feasibility study for a pool, and two of the five sites that the council have identified as possible to build a pool are at the schools, one at Tahurahi and one at Waiheke High. But to follow through the council process, because I guess pools in a sense, or they do fall under one of these regional umbrellas, and so they're doing a regional aquatics network plan, which is looking at the needs across the region. And that plan will be released later this year. And when that's released later this year, it will have missed the opportunity to feed into the long-term 10-year plan. And there's all sorts of complications. In short, if we follow through the council process, we might be looking at a pool in 10 years' time. We see there's an opportunity now, as the school's getting rebuilt, to look at a different model from what the council would traditionally build a pool with, and to get some idea of a council facility. You know, I guess a typical one's the tepid baths across the town. You know, there's a cafe and a gymnasium and the pools and all sorts of other facilities there. You know, to the council estimate to build something like that, we're looking, you know, $6-7 million, and then an annual running cost of between 1 and 1.5. We've had a look around the country at some rural communities that I would suggest are not too dissimilar to Waiheke. Smaller populations, somewhat isolated, don't meet the criteria of their regional funders or the education department or whatever else, and they've entered into community partnerships, you know, and just thought a little bit outside the square. So they may not have all the bells and whistles, you know, and a gymnasium and everything else there, but functionally a pool. And then invariably a partnership either with community group or business that's running that, and they may be helping to fund their operating costs by doing swimming lessons or aquarobics or whatever else. So I guess from my point of view, here's an opportunity that we can actually get a pool, and there's nothing that stops us over the next 10 years working really hard strategically to get that pool possibly even fitting into the council operating model in the future. But getting something in the ground now with the school rebuild.
But I suppose that if we go back to the question, so we go through that process, yep, and we're getting to, you know, we're coming up to October, 2016?
Yeah.
And it's not there, right? There's no hole in the ground. What do you do then? You're not in a position then to go, oh, quick, let's extend the facilities at the sports park.
Oh, no, look, we will know within 4 months. So this board has supported the boards of trustees from all of the schools in the island who all recognise the issues around the pool, and that there's a real possibility that we won't be looking at a school pool period on the island, which will then leave the primary schools in a situation of having to take kids off island for swimming lessons as part of their curriculum. So we've given a grant to the boards of trustees to seek a feasibility study. And that study involves talking to all of the schools in New Zealand that are operating community pools, exploring their partnership models, how they work, how they function, what they've cost to get built, going out to architects, civil engineers, pool specialists, and really getting a good best estimate, broad brush, as to what it's going to cost us to build a pool. And it might be in a stage process, so we're looking at a pool on the ground now and looking at covering it at some stage in the future, but actually getting that stuff concrete, going out to community groups, getting an assessment as to what the uses of the pool are, how many people are going to use it, how justifiable is it, and then looking at building a business model. And we'll have that back within 3 or 4 months, and that's either going to say yes, there's a case here, or there's not. And if in 3 months' time there's a case, you know, then it's up to the schools and the community at that point in time to say, okay, how can we actually make this work if we've got a will to do this or whatever. So we, you know, we're looking over the, you know, this is all going to be happening in the next 6 months, and either yes it is or no it isn't. And within that, within this, the scope of this conversation, the the thrust of the conversations that we've been having with the various affected parties, one might call them, but essentially the sports clubs that are operating up at the Onitangi Sports Park, various community groups that have got aspirations for the old library space, which was one of the budgets, but also looking at the boat ramps area as well. You know, really looking to get outcomes where, you know, everyone can get what they're hoping to achieve. And I guess ultimately when I look at the Onitangi Sports Park, the soccer club approached the local board last year with a proposal once they had a lease on their, what was a tractor shed, still largely looks like a tractor shed, and they came to the board with a proposal and said, look, we'd like to do this, make an extension, move a water tank, put some doors and windows in. The council had that costed at around $70,000. And so when we look at the needs of the clubs, that, you know, there's some work that can be done outside, there's some modifications such as that, and if we can, you know, get these modifications done for a lesser amount of money, so there's still a good outcome for the sports clubs, for the community at the park, you know, there's $400,000 set aside to remodel the old library space down here. You know, and I'd like to think that we can do that for a hell of a lot cheaper. And just recently, the council have come in with a cost estimate of around half of that to do that work. So, you know, we're not really looking at an outcome that's going to deprive everyone of what they're hoping to achieve.
So if we get back to the consultation, so you've had a number of consultation meetings so far. I mean, what are the big items that people are coming and talking to you about?
So with respect to the annual plan, which of which the written submission process is closed,
yeah.
We had formal hearings last week. You know, the issue is the pool.
Yeah.
That's it, period.
Yeah.
You know, there's some other peripheral things, advocacy items, the Esplanade, wetland issues, and things like that there, which, you know, which are issues. But that's the issue there.
Yeah.
As far as the local board plan is concerned, and we've got the last two consultations on this today, we've the six priorities are building a sustainable and prosperous local economy, preserving and enhancing our jewel in the crown, our coastline, harbours, islands and marine areas, places for people, fostering strong, vibrant and engaged communities, providing connected, healthy and friendly transport options, and Matete, our gateway and harbour. Matt, let's start from the back and work back along again. So, you know, Matete, that public consultation on that is today, this afternoon, 4:30 from memory. And you know, there's no rocket science for guessing what the issues are there. There's a myriad of plans that have been developed for Matete over the year, either by private developers when they owned a chunk of the land there, or more recently by council. But invariably, they've either been sort of vetoed politically or whatever else. And we're in a situation at the moment where, you know, a private development company, and good on them, have put an application for a marina. You know, my frustration in this area is that we're sort of the council and now the Environment Court's having a conversation about the marina in absence of any strategic plan that looks at the most strategic bit of infrastructure on the island, and that's an issue. Not just at Matete, but it's
I was going to say, you're big on strategic plans.
But it's probably the biggest issue at Matete, you know, or on the island today, is Matete and getting this thing sorted out. And there needs to be some strategy to this, Chris, and it's, you know, and I guess in context, you know, we've got a district plan which regulates what developers can do, but there's no plan that actually says what the community wants and what outcomes we want out of that space or any other space. And as a consequence of that there, you know, we're sort of open, you know, for all sorts of excitement over the coming years as, you know, the world economy, you know, begins to roll again and developers will be lining up their coastline. You know, but we need to make sure that we've got adequate provision for, you know, for commuter parking, that we're sorting out our infrastructure. You know, the community's long aspired to ensure that as many people as possible that are coming to the island are, you know, walking, cycling, busing in and out of the ferry terminal, and yet it's got one of the crappiest bits of footpath on the island. It's got crap cycling infrastructure. You know, there's fisticuffs between bus drivers and taxi drivers and shuttle operators down there. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare that needs to be addressed with urgency. We've got some of the most significant heritage in the Auckland region in that bay. You know, around the coastline there, but also with this the sequence from, you know, the Urupara on the foreshore through to the old Ellison homestead, which previous to that belonged to the Auckland Harbour Master and was, you know, shifted to the island, was built in the 1840s. But there's this whole sequence of stories there that people can associate with. You know, history is the biggest tourist driver, and yet we're not celebrating it. We've got this wonderful stuff there. Why aren't we?
So in terms of the local plan then,
yep.
I mean, what, you know, so that's all well and good, but what do you do in the local plan to actually address that local strategy?
So what we're saying in our local plan, quite specifically, is that we want the local board to lead the development of a strategic plan for all council property at Mātietia, and ensure that any development at Mātietia follows a robust planning process building on the social, environmental, cultural and environmental values of the community, recognising Mātietia as a gateway and transport hub. Now, in the absence of an advocacy item, and this and the plan, the local board plan and the local board agreement are the only effective mechanisms for the local board to get any accountability out of council-controlled organisations a la Auckland Transport and Auckland Council Investment Properties.
Yep.
So this is it. You know, this is our only directive that we can give to them as an annual basis to say this is what we want to achieve. And it's their opportunity as well as anyone else in the community to come and submit to the local board and say, we don't want you to do this for X, Y and Z. And the local board makes a decision on that. But at the end of the day, they're bound by it. And so again, whilst the previous local board plan talked about no further development at Mātietia until there's been a review of all of the plans, didn't say who was going to review the plans. You know, the plans have been reviewed, you know, unquestionably by some developers, and now we're looking at some more development at Mātietia. You know, so that's Mātietia. If we flip back to connected and healthy, environmental friendly transport options, there is an absolute bent within Auckland Transport, which spends, you know, over 40% of our rates towards providing really good roading infrastructure for cars. And yes, we need it. But again, the infrastructure for cyclists and walkers invariably falls into a local board budget. And when these guys are spending 46% of our rates, we need to make sure that they're thinking about our other infrastructure and providing for it as a part of that. And one of the planning issues, when we talk about strategic plans, which is very real across the island, and Goodwin Road is a classic example, where that road is busy, it's dangerous to walk up and down, and it needs a footpath. But the council can't afford to build one because there's been a disconnect in the planning process where, as every property's been developed, there hasn't been a communication between whoever's controlling the road and whoever's doing the resource consent for the property. And so now it's a matter of rebuilding every driveway up Goodwin Ave in order to put a footpath in, and no one can afford to do it. And so just getting that simple interface actually working properly and holding council officers to account to say we need this thing.
So how specific can the plan get? Because, I mean, the plan in the past, I think, you know, was pretty broad brush.
Yeah.
You know, how much leeway do you have in there? I mean, can you say, you know, in 3 years we're going to clean up the stream at Little Wani Roa so people can swim in the bay?
Yep.
Can you say in there we're going to address those issues and put a footpath up Goodwin Ave?
Absolutely.
And is that your intention? I mean, the stuff you've got in there, does it get that specific?
Well, you know, so I guess, you know, we've sort of broken down below that heading of providing connected, healthy and environmental friendly transport options down to some other bullet points, which are a little bit more specific. Yes, absolutely. I would like to be absolutely specific to the point that we're putting maps and drawings attached with our plan. And it's not uncommon. You know, some of the other local boards have got a whole hierarchy of information that sits behind this, and we need to get there. You know, if we're actually going to achieve some outcomes and not waste our time, we have to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, and there are some areas, I suppose, where it's more difficult to do that. Say, if you look at the economic development area, where, you know, in the past it's been, well, you know, if we're, basically it seems, well, if we're a nice place, then people will want to come here and that'll be good for the economy.
Yes.
So what have you got in mind there? How do you make that more specific? I mean, you've got this, I suppose, this disconnect between what the local board can actually do and what the local board thinks is a nice idea.
We have to get really smart about how we deal with our economy. And, you know, our economy is driven by tourism, which is great. You know, we've become well recognised as the, you know, the wining and dining capital of the country. But what we've just experienced over the past summer is this, you know, a saturation to the point that it was getting very, you know, or perhaps beyond the point that our infrastructure was coping. And so we have to, so this, you know, so one argument says, look, we have to, you know, put a whole truckload of money into more infrastructure, and we need to get, you know, a monorail through the island or whatever. You know, there's a whole army of things that we could do. and everything in the middle. But then there's another argument that says, well, you know, can we look at developing our economy in other areas, or looking to spread that, you know, that attraction across the year? And again, we've got the resources. You know, I mean, the council-controlled organisation, ATED, Auckland Transport Economic Development, Auckland Tourism and Economic Development, you know, they're very well resourced, and they put a huge amount of money into promoting Waiheke as a tourist destination. And so we need to look at how we can utilise that better to make sure that we're getting, firstly, you know, tourism and economy that spreads across the year. There's other challenges there that we've identified. You know, we've got a hell of a lot of young people that are unemployed on this island, and, you know, I'm concerned that I want my kids to have better opportunities to leave school and work and live on island than working as a barista. Not that there's anything wrong with that, or as a checkout, you know, worker at the supermarket. And so how can we look... And then equally, within my work, you know, you talk to the mechanics up on Tahi Road that can't get an apprentice and can't get an apprentice to stay and work, and all of these things. We need to be working really hard to build these bridges. So I don't think tourist or economic development is singularly just about building a bigger economy, but how do we get our economy to work better for our community so that we're providing opportunities for young people here? And there's a lot of these things that are very interrelated. I think the biggest challenge that our community faces is, you know, when you look over the next 50 years, 30 years, I mean, Auckland's planning or providing for another 1 million people living in Auckland. That's what the Auckland plan envisages. And a lot of those are going to be immigrants. And I think when I look on Waiheke, our way of life revolves around our environment, the fact that we're on an island, we're a special place, we value our environment and our beaches, and it's not polluted, and the trees and the geckos and the birds and the bees. But also our local border encompasses all of these inner Gulf Islands. You've got a whole establishment in Auckland that's very much geared up to dealing with the developmental challenges that face the region. So for me, part of our opportunity is to actually really celebrate the fact that we're responsible for all these inner Gulf Islands, take a stronger sense of ownership, custodianship, get our communities work together, and celebrating all of that there as part of our tourist focus. So there's opportunities, for example, to develop a kayak trail or a sailing trail so that we're utilising better some of our esplanade reserves. You know, how do we actually do that in such a fashion that we've got people coming in here that might not be jumping on a ferry or a plane or a bus or a boat, you know, or a helicopter, say, you know, kayak up to the Marae, stay there? How do we attract people so that they're also feeding into our economy and you know, make it an attractive thing for people to come and wine and dine and do that at other times of year? But also looking at, you know, I think that the kingpin is we need to make sure that we get people that are coming to the island that are coming here because they enjoy our environment. And I think a part of that in another economy that we haven't really tapped into, and I think is a wonderful opportunity, is an education economy. And I think there's wonderful potential to look at, as the Auckland's educational institutes look to expand, providing opportunities for marine education, environmental education, that could be dovetailing with our schools on the island. I just went on the weekend, we were down in Wellington picking up our Land Cruiser with a swimming pool on the roof, and while we were there, we stopped in at this little aquarium at Island Bay. And here's this aquarium that's the size of a shoebox, but it employs five full-time staff that are running educational programs for kids. And it consists of literally a household pump that's pumping seawater through these tanks. And, you know, the local university students go out diving and bring interesting objects in. But it's creating income, it's creating employment. It means that anyone that's coming into that area is coming away with a strong sense of association and attachment for the environment. And I think those are some of the things that we have to really look at celebrating.
Wasn't on a residential beach, though, was it?
Well, it was, yeah.
It's not going to happen here then, is it? Yeah. So, okay. So, I mean, again, I suppose we come back to the thing. I'll just get you to stop banging your hands on the desk,
Paul. Sorry, Chris.
I suppose we come back to, again, yeah, fine ideas, but you know, what do you do and what do you put in the annual plan that's going to support that person staying on the island and becoming a mechanics apprentice?
So there is whole departments in council, and we had this fascinating dialogue with the council community development team, who as a local board we fund to the tune of in excess of $500,000 a year. And there hasn't been a hell of a lot of work done by these guys in Waiheke in recent years, and they came down here, and you know, obviously there's perhaps a greater willingness with the new local board, but you know, there was a just a huge amount of passion that's there, that they're wanting to get stuck in. Part of their mandate is to get these bridging programs working between the schools. Part of ATEED's mandate is to get bridging programs between the schools. Part of ATEED's mandate is to provide support for small businesses so that they can get into council contracts and these sorts of things. We're already paying these guys to do the work. We're just not saying we need it done in Waiheke. And that's really what the plan can deliver in all sorts of fronts. And also with respect to economic development, one of the other things that we've put in there, which is quite significant, and this is in our one-year plan, because we want to get some action on this now, is that we want to be using our council budgets to support our local economy. And it's criminal that so much work from local board budgets or council budgets that's on island, based on island, is going to off-island contractors, and that's just got to stop. And, you know, so there's, again, if it's in the plan, if it's in there in black and white, that you must use local contractors. Sure, there's a procurement process that they have to go through, but at the moment, they're not even giving the local guys the opportunity to have the work. And that's the issue. You know, like, and you can't tell me that it's cheaper to put up a team of builders, you know, who are restoring, you know, or doing up the old Onewa Bowling Club, for example, you know, than getting someone local to come to do it. You know, we've got a boardwalk going through a wetland shortly. We've got really good guys that do this work across island, but we've got a contractor coming for town to do it. And so, when we've got small local business operators that, for whatever reason, haven't got the resources to get a health and safety plan together or to put together a tender plan or a procurement plan, and we're already funding a Department of Council to provide this support and we're not getting it in our community, that's the sort of connection we can make.
Right, so final question, because we're a little bit over time, but just, you know, so the board come in some particular areas with a very, very clear position, and so therefore, you know, mandate from the electors, you know, and I think it's so specifically around the pool. It's very, very clear that that's something you want to do. Now, you're going through the consultation process, and as you say, you didn't need to do some of that consultation, but you have. And there are a lot of people from the sports park, from, you know, the boaties and so on, who say, no, we want that money spent on those projects it was already earmarked for.
Yep.
So where does that leave you if the weight of consultation comes out against, you know, because, you know, squeaky wheels, comes out against the direction that you clearly indicated at the time of the election? Where does that leave you?
Well, it hasn't.
Right.
Simply. But that's, you know, but again, it would be irresponsible of anyone in our position to look at any decision-making process on the weight of the volume of submissions. And we've got to get beyond, and we are beyond that level of, you know.
Ah, there, we heard that in the past. We heard that about the Esplanade. It's not about the submissions, it's about...
But, you know, but there is some really, really good arguments from all of these groups. And so we're looking for outcomes where everyone can get all of what they want.
Good old politician talk. Yep. Win-win.
Win-win.
Yeah.
You know, but hey, look, but we will know. I mean, the challenge for us at this point in time is we've got to sign off our annual plan in the not-too-distant future, and we're not going to have the answers back from this feasibility study on the pool but at the time we have to sign that off. So somehow we've got to couch this conversation that actually provides options for us to, you know, if the... decision of the board is to go ahead with the pool. If that becomes possible, how can we actually word this thing such that we can provide for that, but also give options? And I think the sports park's an easy example where, you know, I think you could put essentially develop a shopping list from, you know, $1,000 items through to $5 million items up at the sports park. We can prioritise them with the user groups up there and the community. And if we wind up with $250,000 in that budget that we're going to allocate to the sports park, we can identify those priorities. And if we wind up with $700,000, we can get a whole hell of a lot more.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you know, universally, I don't think there was... Oh, there were some submissions, but certainly the user groups, be it the sports, the rugby club, the soccer club, the theatre, the gallery, none of those groups have come out in opposition strongly to the pool or the community pool per project at the school. Their concern is to make sure that their activity is still provided for. And that's absolutely reasonable. We don't want to deny them of that.
Okay, but there's still time. You've got a couple of meetings this afternoon, haven't you?
Well, you know, but again, the pool conversation is taking place in the annual plan, so that, yep. those hearings are over. We've now got to have a decision making process. You know, and then, but there's an ample time. This afternoon, we've got a conversation on Matete starting at 4:30, and then the earlier one, which is really significant, which is preserving and enhancing our jewel in the crown, our coastline, harbours, islands, and marine areas, and that's really looking at a whole, you know, a whole raft of things from those educational opportunities through to Little Onewarrow Creek, and absolutely, we need to be absolutely specific with the likes of the Little Onewarrow Creek. And it was really interesting. We had, there's me banging the table again. We had Councillor George Wood, who's the former North Shore Council Mayor, at our annual plan hearings the other day. And I asked the question because I was conscious that, you know, that they've intensively developed that east coast of Auckland, that it also has beautiful beaches that everyone can go and enjoy swimming in. And they won't have tolerated the kind of mess that we've got at Little Onewarrow. And what we're missing is over the North Shore and over many other parts of Auckland, they have what are called catchment management plans. We don't have any, but it looks at the whole catchment, how the wetlands are functioning, how the stormwater's running off the roads, is it low impact, is it best practice, whatever. But it's actually, you know, mapped the plan, looking at the volumes, the 100-year floods, and provides for that. So, what, you know, one example he was giving at the moment, they're spending millions of dollars on a project up there, you know, lowering the level of part of a park to create an artificial wetland to ensure that when the water reaches the beach, that it's well and truly filtered. And those are some of the sorts of things that we need to be thinking about at Little Onewarrow. But also I flag with parts of Onitangi, Blackpool, Surfdale, where all of those drains that you see running up the sides of the roads there are just that. They were drains that have been manually dug through a wetland system. And so what you see is, you know, Blackpool today, 150 years ago, would have looked, you know, dramatically different, obviously, with no houses on it. But, you know, there weren't these straight line ditches that go up and down the streets. So how do we actually provide for, you know, better management of that such that when there's, you know, more development there, it's not polluting all of those bays and beaches?
Yeah, just give Blackpool 20 years, it will be underwater anyway.
Yeah, well, that's
global
true.
Warming. All right, thanks very much, Paul. And check out the Gulf News, which has got the times and places of those two consultations that are happening this afternoon.
Yeah, and I'll just stress that this is a pre-consultation consultation.
Yeah.
You know, and we did promise that we would talk to the community. Maybe we're going a bit OTT. But this isn't the last bite of the cherry. And so once this is, you know, done and dusted, there is a formal structural, you know, consultative procedure to go through beyond that. So
excellent.
Plenty of time to gather your thoughts.
Yeah, then it'll be time to go to an election again. All right, thanks very much, Paul. Paul Walden, Chair of the Waiheke Local Board, here on Island Life.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7pm and Thursdays at 12:30pm. Island Life is brought to you by the Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onewarrow.